The Treasures of Morecambe and Wise, Bring Me Sunshine, written and read by Gary Morecambe. Chapter 1. When Eric Met Ernie. John Eric Bartholomew, to give Eric Morecambe his real name just for one moment, made his first appearance in Buxton Road, Morecambe, on the 14th of May, 1926. His parents, Sadie and George, were having some emergency damage repairs to their council house at number 48 during the final stages of her pregnancy, so Eric was, in fact, born a few doors down at their neighbour's house. A little unusually for the era into which he was born, he was an only child. This gave rise to the forging of a close, lifelong bond with his parents, a kind of us against the big wide world attitude. Sadie, who would be instrumental in forming the Morecambe and Wise double act in years to come, was an intelligent, well-read woman, someone who struck you as being more than the sum of her given parts, certainly someone who rose above all the circumstances with which life presented her. As for many, living in the north of England pre-Second World War, surviving on nothing more than the man of the house was able to bring in, was never an obvious conduit for greater expectations. Indeed, the whole ambience of that era, described to me in detail when I was a child, makes me feel that Dickens might have penned their lives. Sadie was a motivator, not a pushy mother, not someone trying to claim a share of the glory by encouraging her son towards the bright lights of show business. Sometimes in books, articles and films, she is presented as a Mrs. Worthington figure, whom Noel Coward implored not to put her daughter on the stage. It makes for a more exciting story, of course, but is an entirely erroneous presentation of a woman whose only real ambition was for her son to better his lot in life. Recognising a spark of talent in him at an early age, she encouraged him to take the initiative and turn his talent into a life-changing advantage. Show business, therefore, became a natural choice for the young Eric, and he proved very able when it came to winning local talent shows. Once his talent and aptitude were recognised, and he showed no nerves or fear of performing, though a lot of embarrassment during the early days when his mother encouraged him to wear outlandish outfits, Sadie took that as her cue to urge him ever onwards. And she had to do so, because, as my father once told me himself, if she hadn't, I wouldn't have done anything. I was intrinsically lazy. George Bartholomew worked for the Morecambe Corporation, labouring on myriad jobs, from road repairs to digging ditches, eventually spending much of his time erecting scaffolding and preparing stalls for the Lancaster market. George was Sadie's opposite, a man who delighted in the simplicity of life and sought nothing to add to it, because his life needed no additions or adornments. He had his fishing, he had his Heath Robinson bird traps in the garden, he could whistle and ballroom dance. He owned a bicycle and a Frank Spencer-style cap. What more did he need? As Eric grew older, the fact that George could be so relaxed and untroubled, while Eric needed constantly to be on the go, would sometimes become a small bone of contention between them. Eric more closely resembled his mother, although he may have lacked her serene calmness under pressure, a slow starter who became a goal chaser. Eric was also an only child, bereft of sibling rivalry and confident in the assumption that anything passing through the family was his by entitlement. While the Bartholomews were living out their everyday life with its occasional, then more frequent, forays into amateur show business, Ernest Wiseman was doing likewise in his native Yorkshire. Born 6 months earlier than the man who had one day become so close to him that the outside world would view them almost as one life form, Ernie was brought up in East Ardsley, which is between Wakefield and Leeds. Ernie's father, Harry, was a railway porter, and, as with Sadie and George Bartholomew, Harry and Connie Wiseman had been the attraction of opposites. Connie came from a well-to-do family, as it was charmingly called back in the day. Harry was considered far beneath her. Connie's father cut her out of his will for going against his wishes and marrying Harry. Ernie reflected on this time. All she left home with was the piano she had saved so hard for as a young woman. While Eric had clearly gravitated towards his mother's influence, Ernie was more remote from his parents, with a different, individualistic approach to the way his life would pan out. Ernie had four siblings, a lot of mouths for Connie to feed, especially when funds were in short supply in the Wiseman household. Harry's own father had toured Northern Working Men's Clubs as a singer, and Harry followed him, becoming well established on the circuit by the time of Ernie's birth. Ernie's bubbling personality and eagerness to join his father in the show business fraternity of the day soon had the two performing together as Bert Carson and his Little Wonder. Ernie still kept up with his education, something he endured rather than enjoyed. This was similar to his one-day partner's approach to classroom learning, though in Eric's case his absences eventually far outweighed his attendances. Eric Bartholomew, the John had almost immediately been discarded for a reason no one ever clearly made known, was not only allowing his attendances in lessons to slip, but was often found on the school premises, smoking anything I could ignite, as he confessed many years later, not without a little pride. Eric had a clear appreciation and understanding of his mother and how her brain ticked and what inspired her. He knew that her threats in regard to his lack of educational motivation were mostly idle ones. He knew that she saw he had a talent and felt as strongly as he that he needed to get into full-time show business employment as soon as possible in order to start competing with the other young entertainers and would-be stars of tomorrow. For a few years, the Bradford Telegraph and Argus had staged an annual charity show at the Alhambra Theatre in Bradford with the unlikely, and politically incorrect in today's society, name of the Nignog Review. It featured child acts, and Ernie joined the troupe in 1936, appearing in three of these reviews. In 1938, the impresario Brian Mickey was touring the north of England looking for juvenile talent for a review. Ernie had an audition with Mickey and was later contacted by band leader Jack Hilton, who had been given the nod by Mickey about the talented young Ernest Wiseman. Ernie did a very good Chaplin impression, among other routines involving dance and song and jokes. A rags-to-riches journey, or something along those lines, was about to begin for Ernie, as Hilton summoned him to audition for his show, Bandwagon, which was playing in Shaftesbury Avenue in London's West End. Hilton was very impressed, and young Ernie found himself contracted to Hilton for 3 years. While the Railway Porter's Son was now a West End success in the making, it meant the demise of his faltering act with his father Harry. Hilton made it fairly clear to Harry that he was surplus to requirements, and Harry took the train back to Leeds on his own. Ernie was 13 years of age, but would never live at home again. Such were the life changes that had now been set in motion. It would be many years before Ernie would begin to understand how Harry never quite came to terms with their separation. Every plaudit that Ernie enjoyed in the national press must have been a strange concoction of pride and pain to Harry. Ernie was 13 years of age, but would never live at home again. Such were the life changes that had now been set in motion. It would be many years before Ernie would begin to understand how Harry never quite came to terms with their separation. Every plaudit that Ernie enjoyed in the national press must have been a strange concoction of pride and pain to Harry. While Ernie was on his surprisingly short journey from obscurity to child stardom, Eric was reluctantly undergoing music and dance lessons, which his mother was financing through a tea room waitressing job and work for the Central Pier Theatre on Morecambe Bay. "I didn't want to do them, simple as that," said Eric of these enforced lessons. "I never liked the lessons, and I'd much prefer to have spent my time kicking a ball around with my mates." All of that is absolutely true, as I found out when I was privileged to catch up with some of those mates from his youth while researching a book in 2008. They described a solemn, embarrassed young Eric bidding them farewell from their street football matches in Christie Avenue, a daily event, as he went home to change into his top hat and tails to attend his dance lessons. Much mirth and jibing would greet his reappearance, and a poetic picture was painted of this melancholic lad lumbering off, wearing exactly the kind of costume that he would one day wear week in, week out, to delight up to 27 million television viewers. Though Eric's most influential role models were initially Abbott and Costello, and later Laurel and Hardy, which was the same with Ernie, his first comedy hero was Lancashire star George Formby. Eric emulated his style, strumming a ukulele and wearing an ill-fitting costume, singing the Ella Shields number, I'm Not All There. It was such a performance that won Eric a competition in Hoylake, the prize for which was an audition before Jack Hilton. Fate was definitely taking a hand in proceedings. Eric travelled with his mother to a cinema in Manchester, and Jack Hilton was not the only person present at the audition. Sitting next to him was his young protégé, Ernie Wise, as he had now become known. This, however, was not destined to be a landmark meeting of two future giants of British entertainment. One or two meaningful stares were all they managed. Ernie was deeply impressed by Eric's act, and that unnerved him somewhat, as his status as Hilton's rising young star had, up to that point, been unassailable. Eric took to the stage and went into a number called I'm Not All There, recalled Ernie. This he followed with a very polished impression of Flanagan and Allen. How the hell he did it, I don't know. He played each character separately, but somehow wove them together in such a way that we were convinced there were two people up there on stage. After the audition, Hilton expressed interest and said he might well be in touch. As the weeks passed by, there came no word from Hilton's office, bringing both Sadie and Eric to the conclusion that Hilton wasn't really interested in Eric. Then, 3 months later, Sadie received a telegram from Hilton asking if Eric would appear at the Nottingham Empire as one of Brian Mickey's discoveries in the touring show Youth Takes a Bow. My mother was expected to join me as chaperone on the tour, said Eric, and my salary was to be £5 a week plus travelling expenses. A couple of months into the run, Eric heard a rumour circulating that Ernie Wise would be joining them at Swansea. By now, not only had Ernie starred with Arthur Askey in Bandwagon, but as a result of this triumph, he had also made several radio broadcasts for the BBC. Even before I'd won that contest at Hoylake, I knew who Ernie Wise was, recalled Eric. I can remember listening to him and a girl called Mary Naylor on the radio with Arthur Askey and Stinker Murdoch. Ernie was taller than me in those days, and he was in long trousers. He joined the train at Crewe, but I didn't meet him until somebody's mother introduced him to my mother while I was there. He said hi in a breezy fashion and bounced off. I used to watch him on stage and he was good. He could do a good tap dance and he looked so assured, but I thought he was a big head. In fact, Ernie's cockiness at this time was masking homesickness following the initial euphoria of the Bandwagon's success. Sadie instinctively picked up on it and took Ernie under her wing. The three of us were inseparable, Ernie said many years later when recounting the beginnings of his career. Despite the bonding between the three, though Eric and Ernie were still somewhat suspicious of each other, to all intents and purposes, Ernie was without a chaperone and had to make all his own travelling and accommodation arrangements. This he did with great success until the show reached Oxford in 1940. The phony war was over and the city was crawling with troops. He quickly discovered there was not a room to be had. He walked from house to house, knocking on doors, and was on the verge of succumbing to panic when, by chance, he knocked on the digs where Sadie and Eric were happily settled. Fate would play an enormous part in the Morecambe and Wise story, and the conversation overheard by Sadie from the stairway in Oxford was just one of those fortuitous occasions. She recognised Ernie's voice, just as a landlady apologetically had to turn him away from the already full house. We can't turn him away, Sadie said to Eric, and with much irony, bearing in mind the many bedroom sketches to follow decades later in the double act's repertoire, Eric and Ernie shared a bed. There was no looking back after Oxford, and Eric and Ernie's double act evolved naturally out of the time spent on the road travelling together. The moment they became a definite duo was when they found themselves with Youth Takes a Bow in war-flattened Coventry, following Hitler's blitz on the city. Because of the state of the city, they travelled daily to digs in Birmingham. The 20-odd miles each way by train were a desperately slow journey, frequently disrupted. The boys whiled away the time doing gags and impressions, which after a time began to grind Sadie down. Finally, reaching breaking point, she suggested, "Look, instead of all this malarkey, why don't you put your brains to better use and try and do a double act of your own? All you need are a few fresh jokes and a song." Said lightly by a woman whose endurance had been stretched and who was currently separated from her husband while taking on the chaperoning of two young entertainment hopefuls on tour, it was advice nonetheless taken extremely seriously by the two mischief makers themselves. Within days, they had their first routines worked out, a few fast gags and a soft shoe dance to By the Light of the Silvery Moon. Though they had to concentrate on their solo spots, Brian Mickey allowed them the chance to add a double act spot when they reached the Liverpool Empire in August 1941. As far as Eric and Ernie were concerned, they were now a double act, ready to launch themselves on audiences, and the solo spots would soon no doubt be dropped. But while the earliest of foundation stones were put in place, this wasn't going to be a moment that heralded the arrival of a wonderful new comedy team. That was a decade and a half away. It was, however, the beginning of a lifelong partnership and friendship that would take them on the most amazing journey through the next 43 years. While the second half of their remarkable story would move through a whirlwind of glory and achievement, the first half was to be a more turgid and unremarkable affair with moments of sheer despair. For starters, Hitler was standing in their way.